I'm Faith Middleton, and this show is about the richness of life. We're going to talk about books. Thanks for listening in Connecticut, Rhode Island, Massachusetts, and New York, including the East End of Long Island. Great reads coming your way. On this fresh edition of The Book Show, we have books to tell you about, new and classics. And we have an author interview live with Francine Prose about her novel Lovers at the Chameleon Club, Paris, 1932. As has been said, Chameleon Club is based on a true story, a look at the limits of loyalty, love, and art. My book buddies are here. Lee Jacobus, author of Hawaiian Tales. He's reading at Barnes & Noble in Norwalk, Connecticut this Saturday. That's recently published in paperback. And Rose Quiello, she is not published in paperback. She's actually here in the flesh, adjunct professor at Quinnipiac University. Lee Jacobus, what are you recommending, my buddy?
Well, first of all, I got to tell you a backstory. I just got finished 3 months of reading War and Peace. I'll talk about that later. But after I got finished with that, I had to read some mysteries. And so the first thing I read was Elmore Leonard's Be Cool. Now, I love Get Shorty, you know, and Chili Palmer, who is the, you know, the John Travolta character in Get Shorty. Chili Palmer is in Be Cool. And here, this is marvelous because the book is filled with all these inside jokes. Chili Palmer wants to produce a movie, another movie, and he keeps alluding to this movie that he produced, which you know is Get Shorty. And it's very, very comic in a sense. But he latches onto this singer, this young woman named Linda Moon, who's going to have a great band. And he decides that he's going to make a movie about a girl band. And it's going to be, he's going to get into the music business as well as everything else. And of course, everything goes awry. And the fact that he's a former, you know, loan shark and keeps saying things like, look at me, you know, look at me. And then of course, Leonard kind of coolly deals with that by having some other character turn to him later in the novel and say, hey, look at me. And then, you know, you get these inside jokes. It's, I think, a wonderfully fun book. I just went right straight through
it. Is that in paper? That's in paper.
It's an older book, but it's in paper. It's a couple years old.
I don't know
old.
That one.
Yeah.
It's
Be Cool, yeah.
I love him. I absolutely love him. That sounds like actually a great beach read.
Oh, it is a great beach read. Oh, yes, absolutely. And, you know, Elmore Leonard said one thing that I think every writer should always pay attention to, and that is don't write what people don't read. That sounds stupid in a way, but when you read him,
that's
you realize
formula,
the
right?
stuff that he's left out is the stuff you wouldn't want to read anyway. It's very comical. Anyway, it's Elmore Leonard, Be Cool, and as I said, it was like candy.
It was wonderful. He is so good.
Yeah, he is.
All right, Lee Jacobus. Also wanted to say, we'd love to hear from you if you have a book to recommend. And book clubs, we'd love to know what you're reading. 203-776-WNPR. That's the easy way to remember. 203-776-WNPR. Rose Quiello.
Faith, we just had a wonderful book discussion on Americana, spelled with an H at the end, by Ngozi Adichie. I want to spell her last name, A-D-I-C-H-I-E. This is a terrific book about a very smart, strong-willed Nigerian woman that leaves Nigeria, which was under dictatorship, to come to the United States. She leaves behind the love of her life, Obinze, who can't get a visa. Anyway, she comes to the United States and is just taken aback by our attitudes here about race. She makes all kinds of adjustments to the way she speaks, straightening her hair, all metaphorical, of course. The difference between being a Black American, a descendant of slaves many years in this country, and an American Black, like she is, a Nigerian. So anyway, the book is about distant love. It's about race. It's about two people that you're hoping will get together sometime. But what I love about it is her language, the nuances of her language, and that this book is real. I don't know how else to say it. It's unpretentious, unselfconscious, very real. We had a wonderful book discussion. It's called Americana with an H at the end by Adichie.
And that is also in paperback.
Yes.
Yes. Okay. So this is just also out in paperback, the signature of all things. I know a lot of our book clubs have been reading that. It's Elizabeth Gilbert's novel, And it goes across a lot of the 18th and 19th centuries. National bestseller in hardcover, one of the best books of the year in about 47 million publications. I have so many. So I started this, and because of work, you know, I can never, it's very hard to finish things sometimes. But this is every friend I know just loved this book. This is the story of this, you know, quite brilliant young woman, Alma Whitaker, and she's born in 1800 into this kind of Philadelphia family of privilege. And her father is this Henry Whitaker, and he's this a charismatic botanical importer, and he's a pharmaceutical magnate. And so he grew up poor, and her mother, Beatrix, is this strict woman from this esteemed family in Holland. And she knows botany with as much knowledge as any man. And so it's kind of interesting for this time and this woman. And you watch this Alma become independent very, very quickly. And she gets very fascinated with the mysteries of evolution and science. And so you're learning a lot while you're reading. And then she comes up against this guy, Ambrose Pike, and he's her opposite, because he's interested in the spiritual and the divine and the magical. But each of them has this shared passion for, I guess you would say, knowing. That is what is common to the two of them, knowing from his perspective and from her perspective. That's their bond. Wonderful, wonderful, wonderful. Every friend I know says this. So out in paperback now, The Signature of All Things by Elizabeth Gilbert. If you'd like to tell us about a book you love, whether it is a classic that you have reread or remember, a book for children, a novel of any kind, mysteries. You know, we love historical fiction, history. We love it all. Economics, you name it. 203-776-WNPR. Lee Jacobus.
You know, it was probably maybe 7 or 8 months ago, one of the folks who called in to tell us about a book that they really loved mentioned the author Louise Penny, and I wrote it down because I had not heard her. And I just was at the Hickory Stick Bookshop in Washington Depot, and I talked to the owner, and we talked, and she gave me a copy of her first novel, which is called Still Life.
Lee, do you remember that we had done a show,
yes,
on novels that people have forgotten about and that were so loved at the time.
Right.
And that book, Still Life, was on that list.
It was. Okay, well, that's why I have it. It's just wonderful. Yeah. You know, this novel is her first novel. She was a journalist, and she turned to writing mysteries. She won about 5 awards for this novel. It became a tremendous success. And the main inspector is Inspector Gamache. Now, he's wonderful because he makes lots of mistakes. He makes assumptions that are totally wrong and that lead in the wrong direction at times. He also does something that isn't very PC. He actually upbraids a young woman novice inspector on his team. He takes her aside and dresses her down again and again and again. And she keeps thinking, what am I doing wrong? I solved the case. How can he be mad at me? I've tried to be nice to this woman, and he's mad at me. And the neat thing is, no one ever excuses him. He doesn't get redeemed at the end. He, in fact, kicks her out of the team at the end. And that's it. That's the end of it. It's I think, a really daring thing to do.
It is daring.
But this is a mystery about a woman who gets shot by an arrow, if you can imagine it, and they can't find the arrow. And she's a woman that everybody loves, and she's an artist. And it turns out that a subtle analysis of her art ultimately solves the case. This book is very interesting, because you think it's halfway through that it's solved, that everything is taken care of, and then suddenly you do a 360. I mean, she's really a gifted writer in her way. I'm very impressed. And this is Louise Penny, and it's set incidentally in Quebec.
I think I have to borrow that from you.
Yeah, you can. It's set in Quebec, and they do have a lot of very anti-Anglo jokes that are in it, of course. And of course, she is Anglo herself, and she also lives in Quebec, so she knows the area. But she writes as if she were an English country novelist, you know, mystery writer. She's really quite wonderful. And anyway, I recommend it strongly. Still Life by Louise Penny. Just P-E-N-N-Y.
Okay, we like to spell things on this show, yeah, as everybody might know. All right, I wanted to talk about, since Lee brought up mysteries a couple of times, Janet Ivanovich is out with her new book, and it's called Top Secret 21. You want to know something about Janet? First of all, Janet Ivanovich wrote the best book about how to write a mystery. It is fantastic. My hat is off to her. And I see that, you know, I mean, there are parts where they're just quoting characters and from her previous books and trying to show things that way. But it is amazingly instructive and helpful. So this book, Top Secret 21, this is the story of the Stephanie Plum, you know, who's the star of the whole thing. She's from Jersey, and she is this bounty hunter. Right. And comes back again and again in these books. And so this time she is after this criminal boss in New Jersey, who's a used car dealer, Jimmy Paletti, who people will know if they read Janet Ivanovich. And let's put it this way, he's selling more than cars in the dealership. And so she's, you know, this is on a race and there are assassins and, you know, the whole nine yards. So Janet Ivanovich, Top Secret 21. And about her, I would like to say, take a guess how many books Janet Ivanovich has sold.
Oh. It must be 100 million. Probably.
Sorry. No, see, that's my fault. I shouldn't have asked that question that way. So 75 million. You've overestimated her tremendously.
Oh, yeah, yeah, right.
So 75 million in 26 languages. Isn't that something? She's very good at it.
Oh, I saw her at the Guard Theater with 500 women, actually, and me, at the Guard Theater, and she started to make reference to something, and the people in the audience were quoting from her books just off the top of their heads.
Oh, wow.
They knew the books so well, it was astounding. They knew who did what with Stephanie Plum and at what time. It was wonderful.
She's very, you know, everybody's got their style as a mystery writer, and, you know, we have P.D. James and the Scottish woman whose name I'm completely blanking on, whom I adore, and, you know, so many others, and everybody's got this style, and I don't, you know, Janet Ivanovich is short and fast and clever and plots well. And she's just very good at her channel that she's got going. Top Secret 21, Janet Ivanovich. All right, we're going to take a quick break here on The Book Show. We invite you to call and tell us book clubs, too. If you've got a book you like, please spread the word to others. 203-776-WNPR, and then more book recommendations coming your way. Faith Middleton, it's great to have you listening to this fresh edition of The Book Show. Wanted to let you know that in our third segment, just ahead, we're going to be talking with Francine Prose, who is author of this new novel of hers, Lovers at the Chameleon Club, Paris, 1932. And it has everything you might imagine from the title. It's smartly named. What was that? What's that joke about? You know, if you put Lincoln, a dog, and how many things in
Lincoln,
the same time?
Well, if you put Lincoln in anything, and a doctor in anything, and a dog in anything, you got to get a hit. So somebody did a play called Lincoln's
Murder.
Doctor's Dog.
That's it. That's what I couldn't think of. All right, let's go to the phones at 203-776-9677 or 203-776-WNPR, inviting you to tell us about a book that you love, a classic or something new, something you've just stumbled on. That's how we spread the word of a great read. Dana, hi, welcome to the show.
Hi there.
Hi.
I'm going to recommend the new book by Lisa C., China Doll.
Tell us about it. I love her.
Oh, it's awesome. I haven't been able to put it down. It's about the 1940s nightclub scene in the Chinatowns of San Francisco and Los Angeles. And it's so cool because no one, I don't think, has written a book about that, or at least I haven't seen one. And I like it, too, because toward the middle of the book, she addresses the Japanese internment during World War II, which almost no one has addressed in a book either, in a novel anyway.
Yeah, that's interesting, not in a novel, because we certainly have seen a lot of historical treatments of the internment camps, but so that is that's a point. I don't know if there are other novels like that. So did you find you were caring about the characters?
I love the characters. There are three women, two Chinese girls, and a girl who is trying to pretend to be Chinese. She's Japanese, and it's to protect herself, really, because at that time the anti-Japanese sentiment was such that, you know, everyone was afraid. They were terrified. So she tried to pass herself off as a Chinese girl, and it worked for a long time, and until after the bombing of Pearl Harbor, even for almost a year, she managed to keep her identity a secret.
Dana, have you read any reviews of the book that indicate that Lisa C., the author, was using historical stuff from the period? Is this historical fiction in a certain kind of way?
I don't know if I've read any reviews like that, but it is historically accurate. I know quite a bit about that period of history, and I know that she did do a lot of research before she wrote the book. She always does, which is one of the reasons why her books are so fantastic. They're accurate, in addition to being a great read.
Yeah. Great. This is great. Thank you so much for calling about that. So it's Lisa C., S-E-E, and, yep. And the novel is called China Doll.
China Dolls, yep.
Thank you, Dana.
Thank you.
Really appreciate it. Dana called 203-776-WNPR. It reminds me of talking about historical fiction. I haven't talked about him in a long time. E.L. Doctorow.
Oh, yeah.
And Ragtime.
That's true, yeah.
I think might be on my list of just
really?
A novel. I just can't ever forget it. I remember it just practically blowing the top of my head off. How deftly handled,
yeah,
how beautifully he integrated the historical stuff of the time into this cast of characters in fascinating detail. What a talented man. Mm-hmm. E.L. Doctorow. You know, we don't talk about him enough.
Yeah.
You know, go ahead, Rose.
No, he's alive and well at Quinnipiac. He's on the mandatory reading list for all incoming first and second year students.
And is Ragtime one
and
of those?
And it is Ragtime.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes. Mm-hmm.
So Rose Criollo, what do you have?
So I read the book review a few weeks ago in the Times, and they interviewed a woman, Laura Hager-Cohen, I think.
Yes.
And she said, I'm not familiar with her, but she said that her favorite book in the whole world was a book called The Gift, Creativity and the Artist in the Modern World. So Sunday morning, I had to go out and buy The Gift. And I did. And what it is it's really a defense of the value of creativity and the importance of creativity in a culture like ours that is often governed by money and things. And it's a rather scholarly book. I read it all Sunday afternoon with my only interruption, cutting the grass. But it's really a book about what it means to be an artist in today's economic world. And then the beginning of it is really about reads a little like a dissertation. Mm-hmm. Taking the idea of gift back to the early Greek times and the whole idea of reciprocity that goes along with a gift, and then takes that whole idea into the modern world where we say so-and-so has a gift for music or a gift for writing. And then it goes into a nice analysis of T.S. Eliot and Ezra Pound. I read it. Hmm. And then so I want to say that this is a book that it's in its 25th edition, and that is really cherished by artists and anybody who's creative. Well worth the read. A little scholarly, but terrific. The Gift by Lewis Hyde, H-Y-D-E.
The Gift. Okay. Thank you, Rose Criollo. Dave, thanks for calling 203-776-WNPR. Go ahead, Dave.
Hello, Faith.
Hi.
Were you thinking of Tana French when you mentioned that great Scottish authoress?
No.
Okay.
Is she good?
Yeah, oh, she's terrific, yeah. But I called about David Liss's A Conspiracy of Paper. Uh-huh. A friend of mine who was a stockbroker happened to pass it on to me. And it's about, it's a historical fiction about a fellow who was a boxer who became involved with people that were trying to start the stock market in England. And the idea that all of a sudden money was not the only way to have personal value. It was pretty interesting as well as technically challenging because, you know, we're so involved in whether we should invest in the stock market today. And this is a novel that addresses what it was like at the start when stocks first became a possibility for investment.
That's interesting. How do you spell Liss?
L-I-S-S.
L-I-S-S. David Liss, A Conspiracy of Paper. That sounds interesting.
Yeah, he wrote another one called The Coffee Trader, and as a serious coffee drinker, I was all over that. and it was very interesting, too. A little more of a romantic novel, but this guy is good. He's a researcher, and he decided that he liked writing fiction, but it interfered with him doing his scientific research. So during the school year, he researches, and during the non-school year, he writes fiction.
Well, he's got a good gig going there. That's terrific.
That.
That's
enviable.
Yeah, it was interesting. Yeah. Okay, well,
hey,
thanks a lot.
Thank you, Dave. Well, thank you. Oh, you too. Thank you very much. Really, call
bye
anytime.
Bye.
Okay, thanks. Lee Jacobus.
Listen, I've got another one of those books that I just got into and just couldn't get out of until I finished it. I just sat down and read and read and read. And this is also interesting because it's historical fiction, but it's an historical spy novel. Alan Furst, F-U-R-S-T. His book called Mission to Paris is one of several books that he wrote in about what went on in Paris in the 1930s before the war. This is
this is a good match with Francine Prose.
I know it. Well, this is 1938. This the Mission to Paris is in the fall of 1938 in Paris. And what happens is that an American actor who was actually born in Europe but is American, named Frederick Stahl, a great film star, is sent to Paris to do a movie which is in fact about World War I, and it's called Après la Guerre, After the War. And the thing is that he's there and he's in this atmosphere of Paris which is recreated so profoundly. You feel the sense of the weather. My God, it's just amazing how Furst is able to do it. He knows the names of the main barmen, for example, who runs the bar at the Ritz. And these are people that are very well known, apparently, at the time. What happens, of course, is that the Germans try to co-opt him because what he's writing about is, in fact, the political warfare that went on before the war. And this is detailed in such extraordinary way that you just are caught up into it. And Frederick Stahl is a very important man, and he's invited to very important parties by these Germans and German sympathizers, the French who are trying to, in fact, figure out a way not to go to war but to appease the Germans. This is a really profound study in its way, even though it's a spy mystery, of the whole sense of what went on before the war began and what people felt and what these governments were trying to do. There's a lot of the Kristallnacht takes place in November, of course, of this year, and he's aware of it. It's terrifying. Anyway, this is a terrific novel, and it's one of three on this subject. It's Alan Furst's Mission to Paris, and I'm going to go on and read the other two.
I might have to take that too. I'm going to just give me, both of you, just hand the books right over.
That's right.
You reminded me somehow one thing you said. The novels, the thrillers of Daniel Silva. These have become bestsellers. They feature Gabriel Alon, who works for the Secret Service in Israel, Mossad, and is also a restorer very old paintings. And so he does these two things. And so it gets into the politics of the region. And he's always either running from someone or chasing someone and doing both. And they're fascinating.
Yeah, no, he's really
Talk
good.
About good beach reads. These are good. The work of Daniel Silva, S-I-L-V-A. Lee was talking about Alan First, Mission to Paris. We heard about Elmore Leonard. What was that title, Lee?
Be Cool.
That's right. Be Cool.
Be Cool, yeah.
Elmore Leonard. Yeah. Americana. And what was her last name again?
Adichie.
A-D-I-C-H-E.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Okay. And Lisa C's China Doll. Robin, welcome to the show.
Hi.
Hi, Robin. Thanks for calling 203-776-WNPR. Go ahead.
Hi, Shay. Thank you. I was calling to mention a book because the previous caller was talking about novels dealing with the Japanese internment. And one favorite in my family is, which was also an award-winning bestseller at the time, but Snow Falling on Cedars.
Oh, right.
Yeah, sure, of course.
By David Gutterson.
Right. I forgot.
Yeah.
Which is such a beautiful story taking place in the Pacific Northwest and the whole Japanese culture and the strawberry farmers on the island and this kind of the relationship between the storyteller in the book talking about his relationship with the Japanese girl and falling in love with her this cultural bridge and the betrayal of the Japanese Americans and how their friendship couldn't even really survive that. That's a great story. So I just wanted to remind the other caller about that book.
Snow Falling on Cedars, David Gutterson. Thank you so much.
Sure.
Really appreciate that. That's a very good reminder. Robin, before you get on, I wanted to mention, I was trying to remember, you have to forgive me. Oh, did I mention this? I couldn't figure it out, so I'm going to do it anyway. The Lemon Orchard has come out. This is Luann Rice's book in paperback. And this is one of her love stories. This is about Lemon Orchard. Visited by a woman named Julia, and her daughter has died, and she's grieving and just wants to be alone with her dog. And then, she finds herself drawn to the man who is overseeing this orchard, and there the story begins. So The Lemon Orchard by Luann Rice, and she will talk and sign books July 26th at the Old Lyme Connecticut Midsummer Festival. And we wanted to let you know about that. Here's our number, 203-776-WNPR, here on The Book Show. David, go ahead. It's Faith. Hi, David.
Hi, Faith.
Hi.
I wanted to talk about two different authors. One of them, Michael Connelly, and I wanted to get your panel's opinion.
I love him. I can tell you right off the bat.
Enough.
Oh,
yeah,
I know.
Can't get enough.
He's so good.
And as far as summer reading and beach reading, he's got Harry Bosch, he's got Mickey Haller, he's got characters that interconnect through all of his novels, and he's fantastic. So I wanted to recommend Michael Connelly. And the second, I wanted to give a plug for a Connecticut author who I actually had the pleasure of meeting a couple of times, Matthew Dix. He's a teacher in Connecticut, and he's written a few novels, and one of them specifically is called Unexpectedly Milo. And it's a quirky novel, and he talks about a lot of landmarks in Connecticut, and just a fantastic author as well, Matthew Dix.
That is great. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. And I'm writing down all of your recommendations.
Okay, and I'm writing down Unexpectedly Milo. Is it M-I-L-O-E or W?
M-I-L-O, Unexpectedly Milo.
Oh, just M-I, okay, got it.
And Matthew Dix is the author. He's he's pretty prevalent on social media, if anybody wants to look for him. He's a very interesting man. He's an elementary school teacher in Connecticut, and he started writing novels. And I think he's had three published so far, but all of them are based in Connecticut and very interesting.
Okay. Thank you so much for calling in. Yes, that's it. Okay. Thank you. 203-776-WNPR. WNPR. I'm with Rose Cuello and Lee Jacobus, my book buddies, here on the show. In just a little bit after our break, we're going to be talking with Francine Prose. She is a National Book Award nominee and has a new novel out called called Lovers at the Chameleon Club, Paris, 1932. So we'll talk with her in our final segment. Is this MD? Welcome to the show, MD.
Yeah. How you doing?
Great, thanks. Good to have you with us. Go ahead.
Yes, I came across a book on Facebook, actually. It's called Eternal Optimism. And okay. The subtitle is, Hope is the Cause of Love, and They Cannot Exist Without Each Other. And it's written by Selfless.
It's written by?
Selfless, the opposite of selfish.
Uh-huh. Interesting. Okay.
Yeah,
So what happened to you after reading that?
I'm sorry. Can you repeat that?
Yes. How did that book affect you?
It affected me by it allowed me to understand love and how to view other people's approach towards you. And no matter what they did, whatever their approach was, I saw it from a different perspective and understood that they were only doing what they did in pursuit of happiness.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
So I forgave them, regardless of whatever they did.
So this is great, MD. Thank you so much. Eternal Optimism.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. Call anytime. All right, that was great. 203-776-WNPR. We're going to take a break now. We've been with Rose Cuello and Lee Jacobus, and now we're all going to have a chat by phone with Francine Prose, author of Lovers at the Chameleon Club, Paris, 1932. Stay with us. I'm Faith Middleton. Thank you so much for listening to this fresh edition of The Book Show. I want to also say how much I appreciate the work of the producers for this show. I'm talking about Jonathan McNichol and Lori Mack. All right, Francine Prose, author of 17 works of fiction, is among our most respected writers, and her newest novel is Lovers at the Chameleon Club, Paris, 1932. The Chameleon Club is a cabaret. It's one of those places where people can be who they are or long to be. Straight, gay, cross-dressers, eccentrics, those who love the experience of nightlife revelry, whatever that might be. These places are still all around us, of course, chock full of complicated, fascinating stories and characters. Francine Prose's story is based on a real Brassai photograph, and it involves spies and Hitler and artists and race car drivers and more, offering a story about the complication within love and loyalty and the loss of what matters most. Francine Prose, welcome back to the show.
Oh, thank you, Faith. I love your description of the novel. I couldn't have said it better myself.
Oh, I'm so glad. You know, it makes me nervous with someone like you especially. I thought, how can I be reflective of what you do and fair and thank you. So I am also with Lee Jacobus and Rose Cuello, so they might jump in at any point. So the photograph that inspired you in some way, can you discuss that picture?
Yeah, it's a photograph by the great French-Hungarian photographer Brassai, and it was taken in a nightclub in 1932, and it's two women sitting at a cafe table, and one is wearing an evening gown, and one is a cross-dresser, and she's wearing a man's suit and a pomaded hair and a pinky ring.
And these were real people of the day.
And these were real people of the day, and the woman, and what I found out years after loving the photograph, is that the woman in the tuxedo was a French athlete by the name of Violette Morris, and she'd been an auto racer, professional auto racer, and a discus thrower, and when the French government took away her license to compete because she was a cross-dresser, Hitler found out about it, and she went to Berlin as his guest, and by the time to the Olympics, and by the time the Olympics were over, she was spying for the Germans and told them where the Maginot Line ended, and became a torturer for the Gestapo. So that was that was a little bit of research I turned up. I mean, that, you know, the internet being the internet, that took about 10 minutes. She has a Wikipedia page, and then the novel really was an attempt to figure out how those things could have happened and how those few things that I knew about her could be strung together so that they made sense.
Yeah, so this is very interesting to me about the Hitler business, because when I was reading the materials in advance of starting your book, and I came to that part, that was the one that got me the most. And so how did you decide that what motivated her to what motivated Hitler in the first place to use her, and then what motivated her to conspire with him?
Well, what motivated him to use her, I mean, even though, as we know, his persecution of homosexuals was ferocious, he realized that that because she knew people all over France, I mean, there was a huge network of sports clubs, of athletic clubs, because then it was still quite rare for women to participate in sports, relatively rare. So every little town had its women's athletics association, and when she'd been a race car driver and an athlete, she had gone around to all these little clubs and lectured about women in sports and so forth, and he understood, Hitler, and I guess it was Heydrich as well, understood that she had these contacts, and so she was in a perfect position. I mean, if there was a troop movement or a new construction project or a shipment of military material, she would know about it because people would tell her. So Hitler and his men basically overcame whatever prejudice they would have had against her and how she dressed and who she was, really, and realized how useful she could be to them.
So they were practical, which is kind of an interesting, you know, I can certainly, you know, through resentment and outrage, see some of these people in a one-dimensional way. I'm talking about the Nazis. Mm-hmm. And there is a painter in New York who does these imagined scenes of things that really happened during the war. And when you see the individuals and their characteristics and gestures, it changes you. You realize that human beings did this.
Isn't that shocking? Endlessly shocking. Really, all these years later and having known about it for so long, I'm still shocked by it. And I think some of my work comes out of that continuing shock.
Yes, yeah, that's what I was trying to get at. So the woman who plays Lou, I call her, that is her name in the novel, who plays the athlete, what would you say is her motivation for, turning on the French and revealing all the things to Hitler that she did to the army?
Well, you use the word resentment, which I think is a big part of why she did what she did and why the Germans did as well. But also, you know, she was someone who was unloved, who had a terrible childhood, who had bad luck in love, who was prevented from doing the work she wanted to do through no fault of her own. But, you know, finally, there are lots of people to whom all those things happen and have that situation and undergo the kinds of suffering she did and don't wind up becoming torturers for the Nazis. So so finally, what I wound up thinking was that it's a mystery, really. I mean, there's a character in the book who keeps saying it's not accidental that they call mystery an evil. I mean, call evil a mystery. Well, it is a mystery, and I think her character is a mystery. And you know, as I was writing the book, I was very conscious that I was not going to find an explanation for what she did. And so it wasn't a mistake in the book. It was something that I did on purpose because I knew that's the only place it could go to.
Yeah. Francine Prose, author of 17 novels. Her newest is Lovers at the Chameleon Club, Paris, 1932. Francine, we should tell you that earlier in the show, I was, you know, saying that you were coming on, and I kept saying the title, and I burst out laughing at one point because I said, you know, this is like putting Lincoln and a dog in the title because you have every great word, you know, Chameleon Club, Lovers, Paris, 1932.
It's a mouthful.
It's not a mouthful. It's just intriguing all by itself. So do you find that this novel, in the end, is a lot about loyalty? And do you find that that is a subject that keeps coming up for you?
Loyalty, absolutely loyalty. And then also, I don't know what courage I would say. You know, one of the things that interested me was to see, you know, you create all these characters, and I don't know, other writers, it may be different for them, but I never really know what they're going to do. I mean, it often really is a surprise. So I wanted to create this bright, shining, glittering, attractive world of Paris in the 20s and 30s, and then have the war start and the occupation and the invasion, and then really to see what each of the characters did. I mean, it was a surprise to me. So, yes, their loyalties to their country, to each other, to their lovers, to their friends, and then their unexpected, what do I want to say, depths or shallowness of character that made them do what they did.
So, and I know, Lee, you have a question. That is interesting to me because when I think about, well, I was going to say F. Scott Fitzgerald and Great Gatsby, but also what happened to the movies. You know, yeah. They portray, you know, that period where everybody in the 20s is kind of filled with a kind of madness and joy and reverie, and as if everybody's an idiot, you know, running around with, you know, in fast cars with scarves on. When I look at the crowd and I think, what are you doing that for? Why are you painting this brush this way? These are these are all complicated people. Where is the story for these people? And I think that's some of what you're getting at. Lee Jacobus.
Yeah. One of the questions I wanted to ask you is about the way in which you work with characters. I understand that the idea that the characters are going to take you places that you didn't expect to go, and they'll develop in ways that you didn't expect them to develop. But when you're dealing with historical characters, how much are you inhibited by the fact that they actually did live a life and you've got to accommodate that?
Well, in each of the cases, I mean, there are two characters. I mean, Lou Villar, the spy, is based on a real person, and the photographer is very, very, very loosely based on Brassai. And then their cameo appearances from Picasso and Hitler. But they don't really do anything that they might not have done in real life. And the others, all the others are really composites and imaginary. I mean, they're only two vaguely real characters and two real characters. So I didn't feel particularly constrained. I mean, I wanted to make the history, I didn't want to make mistakes. I mean, I didn't want to make the sort of mistakes that would throw the reader out of the novel. Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't, you know, I was very careful not to say that something happened when it didn't act, you know, right. I didn't say the 1935 Berlin Olympics, obviously. But I also felt incredibly free to sort of make up, I mean, for example, there are several racetracks in the book. One of them has its real name and one of them has a made up name. Mm-hmm. So, and I, you know, I thought, well, why not?
Right. Do you make discoveries, though, as you write, I mean, about your characters and about what happens to them? And that's what you seem to be implying, and I'm sure it must happen to you at times.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. And again, in this particular case, because the stakes were so high, the decisions they made, I mean, there's a character, the Baroness, who's, an art collector and married to a very, very rich man, and sort of imperious and sort of spoiled, and I think her, the way she changed and was changed by the war and what she did during the war probably came as the biggest surprise to me when I was writing the novel. I mean, wonderful. I thought I knew her. Yeah. And then when things happened the way, I'm tempted to say the way they happened, even though I wrote them, but that's how it felt. I thought, well, you know, she possessed greater depths than I knew when I was writing the character.
This brings us, and thank you for that, Lee, to this idea of what happens when we, as readers, don't like somebody. And the reverse, you know, the reverse is always the joy when someone turns out to be someone lovable in the end. You might not like in the beginning, and then it becomes deeper and richer, and you end up falling in love in that way. It can happen that sometimes, as a writer, you're not giving us someone to fall in love with. Somebody just stays the way they are. Is that a surprise to you too? I mean, is that uncomfortable?
Yeah. Well, you know, I think it's a funny thing because in real life, we all get used to making allowances for people's foibles. I mean, and, you know, obviously doing the sorts of things that my character did are, you know, beyond foibles. But nonetheless, I mean, we get used to our friends and loved ones doing things. You know, your friend is always late, so you make allowances and never meet the person at a pub, you know, on a street corner. I mean, you just learn your way around it, or your family member. But I think in fiction, somehow, people want characters to be more identifiable one way or the other, you know, a good person or a bad person. And I think, in a way, if I'm trying to be lifelike or naturalistic in the characters, I think people in general are a mix of good and bad qualities, or, you know, desirable and not so desirable qualities. And I'm just trying to, I'm trying to do that. I mean, obviously in this novel, some have a much higher balance in one direction than the other, right. But I think that's true as well.
Yeah, oh, I do too. Mm-hmm. I was thinking about you sitting there writing and someone presents him or herself to you and you're going on and then you experience some sense of surprise, for instance, about the Baroness, Lily de Rossignol, right? And so she becomes a transformed person in a certain way. I think I'm trying to find out whether you start directing the action where you say, oh, you know, Lily, you're a little thin. You know, I need to make you more complex. Or does Lily get to have her way with you, you know?
Well, it's very situational. I mean, because what's happening in the novel, someone needs her to do something, and someone asks her to do something. And then the question is, how does she decide, one way or the other? It's a clear decision that has to be made. And then, you know, again, it's not as if I'm not slightly directing it, but at mm-hmm. this point I think, okay, who's this person, and what would be the decision she would be likely to make in that situation, and why? So it's not as if I'm beefing up the character with a little decency. I mean, I'm thinking, oh, here's this strain of courage and independence and decency that was there all along, maybe, but needed the right situation in which to emerge.
I love that,
you know,
description.
What I'm saying?
I do. I love that. Right there is, I think, just an enlightening moment about what a novelist does. That is so good, Francine.
Thank you.
You know, because we try and understand the mystery of this, as I'm sure you do. Lovers at the Chameleon Club, Paris, 1932. We're on the phone with Francine Prose, and this is her newest novel. I'm with Rose Coelho and Lee Jacobus. Now, I'm going to ask you a very practical thing. So we've got, for those who are just joining us, this is Paris in the 1920s. There is, you know, as you say in the book, there's passion, there's art, there's discontent. There are these jazz venues, the Chameleon Club at the center of all this. How in the world, we have about a minute left, do you keep this straight? This is a long book, and I just think I could no more keep, there are characters, situations, atmosphere, the politics of the period, the Nazis. I just think, how in the world do you keep this straight?
It was really hard. I got a whiteboard. I went out and got a whiteboard and those pens
great.
That you write on and can erase.
Yeah.
And I made a grid and I just set things up in it because you're right. I mean, there was a lot just to keep straight on the simplest level.
Oh, that's
what
terrific.
Happened when, how old everybody was, where they were, blah, blah. So I just, you know, I tried to be as organized as I possibly could. I mean, I still forgot things. I repeated things. And then, you know, that's one of the joys of revision.
And, yes, bless the editor. All right. Thank you so much, Francine Prose.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, you're welcome. Lovers at the Chameleon Club, Paris, 1932. Thanks to everybody. This show is about the richness of life. You can find the books we talk about and everything else online at wnpr.org. Search programs for the Faith Middleton Show. In New Haven, I'm Faith Middleton.